All right. So let's have a look at the question. Okay, I want to take your question first because you can't laugh. I'm gonna turn it upside down. I'm gonna shake it about a little bit, so we're gonna kind of shuffle them like cards and then we see what happens. Yeah. Right. Quite a few questions here. Okay, let's just start with this one. 15. What does 15 mean? Does that mean that there are 14 questions before that? Oh, yeah. Okay, all kind of questions. All right, okay. Whoa. Okay. This is going to take a while to get this sorted out. So I shouldn't have shuffled them so much because that kind of destroyed the sequence. Okay. Okay. Someone has really written down an enormous number of questions. So, okay, maybe this is where it starts. I'm not sure. Let's see. There are so many questions. I think I'll just go for the other ones first. Otherwise, we're going to be here for a long time. So let's see what happens. Dear Ajahn, thank you for teaching us and bringing understanding of the suttas to us. I was wondering, how do we guide individuals who are confused between the Taoist idea of Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, and Buddhist concept of it? They believe in Kuan Yin as an all-encompassing God that would bless and punish them accordingly. Also, though the five precepts says no alcohol, sometimes I find myself craving the high that comes with it. How may I face this challenge? Okay. So, how do you guide individuals who are confused and who believe in Kuan Yin? If you believe in Kuan Yin, it is a bit like believing in God, right? It's this idea that you have some kind of God that will look after you and will kind of make sure that you're okay when you go to the heavenly realm and will kind of help you. The problem with these kind of ideas is that you just don't know. Yeah, this is too uncertain. How do you know that there is this kind of being, Kuan Yin? How do you know? Are you really willing to place your life in the hands of something uncertain? It gives you far more power, far more agency in the world if you are in charge of your own life, rather than putting your life in the hands of something else. And this is the problem with all of these kind of theistic religions, whether it's Kuan Yin or Christianity or whatever it is that you're basically saying, let some other deity, let some other entity look after me. I don't know what this entity is. I don't know who they are. I don't even know actually if they exist. But I hope they do, otherwise I'm in trouble. Yeah. So, but instead of kind of putting all that responsibility in the hands of another being, take responsibility for yourself. It is far more satisfying in the long run to take responsibility for yourself. It gives you a sense of being in charge, being responsible for your own life. That is what is really interesting. And this is what makes the Buddhist path so special, because each one of us takes responsibility for our own lives. We don't hand that responsibility over to someone else. And this is what I would say. You don't know about Kuan Yin. Okay, people talk about this, but there are other people who say Kuan Yin doesn't exist. So who is right? Well, you don't know. Make sure you live well now, because that you can be absolutely sure that if you live well now, then you will find a degree of happiness and satisfaction. And that is what you should be going for, instead of kind of allowing Kuan Yin to become the master of your life. So something like that, yeah. And it's kind of nice. I remember my father. This was actually he was a businessman, and he traveled all over the world, and he came to Malaysia also quite often. And he did some business deal in Malaysia, and he was in a dinner afterwards, and there was this lady. She was some kind of executive in some kind of shipping line or something, and they were talking. And then this lady, she must have been some kind of Chinese background. And Kuan Yin speaking, Kuan Yin complaining. And so this lady was sitting next to him, and she was telling my father that, oh, actually, I converted from Buddhism to Christianity. Maybe she thought my father would be pleased, yeah, because she had become a good Christian instead of being a Buddhist. I don't know what she thought. That's what she said. And so my father asked her, well, why? Fair question. And she said that, well, Christianity is a much better deal. So she was a businesswoman. She wanted a good deal, right? So, and the deal, of course, is in Christianity. You put all the responsibilities in the hand of God. God look after you. You don't have to worry anymore.
Buddhism, you have to work really hard. You have to do all these kind of things. Five precepts, meditate. Too much trouble, right? So actually, Christianity is a better deal. But maybe it's too good a deal. Maybe it's too good to be true. And I think that is the point. Yeah, the point is that the deals are too good to be true. When you put the responsibility into the hand of someone else, well, there's a reason why they kind of look too good to be true. Probably they are too good to be true. And in general, in my experience of the world, if the majority of people have a certain view of the world, very often it is the wrong view, because the majority of people are deluded. The majority of people believe in a creator God. Maybe that is the wrong view because of that. Very often we get the opposite argument. Well, everyone believes in a creator God, you should believe it in too. Actually, no. It's the other way around. Because everyone believes in it, I should not believe in it. Because everyone else, the majority of people, are going to be deluded. So try to make this, just gently, yeah, you can maybe make some very gentle suggestions to people in this way, that actually this whole creator God business is actually very dodgy and very dangerous. And even Kuan Yin, someone who's going to look after you, you don't know if Kuan Yin is going to be there when you need her. Who is this Kuan Yin anyway? Does she really exist? Has anyone ever seen Kuan Yin, really? People may have seen things like light in the meditation, may have seen something beautiful, but what is it? Is it Kuan Yin or is it something else? Very often the name and the way we interpret these things are very different from the actual nature. So it's often just a mirage. It's not a real reality. Yeah, please. Yeah. Yeah, I think probably Kuan Yin is many things to different people, and for some people it may be a symbolism of something greater. For other people it may be, they take it to be a real goddess. For other people it may just be a faith thing. It may be many different things to different people. But if it's taken as a symbolism, that's probably maybe the best way of taking it. Because then you're not adding something which may not be there. You're not adding some kind of extra bit to reality, yeah? And so I think that is an important point. The problem is that a lot of these things actually come out of Mahayana Buddhism. Yeah, Mahayana Buddhism had the idea of Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara then becomes Kuan Yin in the Chinese Buddhism, and it kind of moves across like that. But the whole idea of bodhisattvas and all of that whole thing is a bit dodgy. Where does it come from? It is a development in Buddhist history. It doesn't really come from the Buddha. How valid is it? Is it really something that we should follow? So all of these things are kind of slightly dubious, and therefore kind of, to my mind, ideas that are best kind of left by the wayside. And so, you know, you can argue with your family member or whatever that actually these things, you know, go back to the early teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha is the one who is wise. All of these later teachings, including Avalokiteshvara, including Kuan Yin, they are rooted in the Buddha, rooted in the Buddha's teachings. Without the Buddha, none of these things would exist. So why not go to the source? Go back to where everything came from. Go back to the Buddha. That is the best way, because that is the most solid thing that we have in Buddhism. Everything else is later developments that arose. We don't know where. We don't know who spoke these things. And that's why they can be a bit dangerous. Anyway, let the five precepts, says no alcohol. I find myself craving the high that comes with it, how to face this challenge. Just remember that the Buddha recommended not to drink. Yeah, and if the Buddha recommends not to drink, it means that it's a good idea not to avoid it. Yeah, and it's quite easy in the sense that you're craving the high, but because you are, you know, basically, you know, one of the things that I found when I was drinking alcohol is that it also clouds the mind. Yeah, you feel you lose a sense of clarity, your sense of direction. And this kind of makes it very difficult sometimes to keep your precepts and to live in the right way. So look and see if you can think clearly, if you can make good decisions and all of these kind of things once you have using alcohol. And then when you do that, it actually starts to become quite repulsive. To me, the idea of drinking actually has become quite repulsive because I can feel that it kind of destroys my ability to be mindful and clear. I could see that even before I became a monk. And I didn't really want to drink anymore towards the end because it just seemed really, really repulsive. So try to see the consequences of how it works and how it stops you from actually being able to live well. There can be a lot of social pressure with drinking. Yeah, all your friends drink. And because of that social pressure, it's easy to kind of give in. But sometimes you just have to make a choice. Okay, doctor's orders, don't drink. And then you don't drink because you know it is the right thing to do. That's really the way to go to move forward. All right, Ajahn, when you talk about the asava, it reminded me of the Sabhasava Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 2. Can you explain more about the meaning of fermentation, to abandon by using? What it says there? By using, I think it says there. Fermentation is the translation, one of the translations of asavas used by Venerable Tanissaro. I'm not sure if I like it, actually, because asava is also alcohol. That's why he calls it fermentation, because it bridges the gap between alcohol and the other meaning of the word asava. And using is the idea in that sutta of using the requisites in the right way. Yeah, this is kind of the using in that sutta. And the idea then is that, for example, when you eat your alms food, you eat food for the purpose of being able to practice in the right way. You don't eat too much, so you become too full and you fall asleep. Yeah, don't eat too little, so you become hungry in the evening. You eat food that is suitable to the body. This is basically what using is about. And you use your requisites in your life, whether you are a monastic or a layperson, in such a way that it actually helps you to practice. It doesn't make you conceited because you got very fancy clothes or a fancy car or whatever. Yeah, you use these things in a kind of... It's okay to have a fancy car, but don't be conceited about it, you know, that kind of stuff. So you use the requisites in the world in such a way it doesn't lead to defilements, but it leads to an even mind. It doesn't lead to greed, doesn't lead to aversion, doesn't lead to conceit and these kind of things. That is the idea in the Sabhasava Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 2. Okay. Sukhihontubhante. If a fact is not truthful but beneficial, which prevails, usually, if something is not truthful, it will also not be beneficial. Yeah, usually these things go together, because if you have to lie or you have to kind of pretend that something is wrong, then usually in the long run it will not be beneficial. Maybe in the short run you can see some benefit, but overall it will not be beneficial. And this is why the whole thing, the whole purpose of the Buddhist path is to see reality, see things according to reality. Yeah, it is all about truth. Because when you see things in accordance with reality, then you can make good decisions. It's a little bit distracting when you talk at the back there. Is it possible to not talk so much, please? Is that all right? Is it necessary to do it now, or can you wait? Are you able to wait? Yeah? Okay, thank you. Otherwise, it's kind of it becomes a bit distracting thing for everyone. So if you can wait, that'd be great. Thank you. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So it is all about truth. Because when you actually see things according to reality, then you can make decisions according to reality. Then you can make good decisions in life, right? But if you don't see things according to reality, you're going to make decisions based on falsehood, and then things are going to go wrong. And the idea is very much like, for example, if you're going down to the shop to buy something because they have dinner or whatever. If you don't know where the shop is, that means you don't know things according to reality. You will never get to that shop. You never have dinner, and so you suffer. So if we make decisions based on the non-reality, we're going to end up suffering because our decisions are going to be bad as a consequence. So truth is very important. If it is not true, then basically it is not going to be beneficial in the long run. So truth is beneficial. Untruth, usually not beneficial. So usually that problem should not usually arise. If it is only for short-term benefit, please don't think short-term, think long-term benefit. My girl argued she is unable to utter thank you because it's not truthful at her space, since there isn't any gratitude felt towards that individual. But I told her it's beneficial to express gratitude. Her reply, I will be lying if I said thank you without meaning it. Isn't being truthful important? Please help, Ajahn. Thank you with metta. Well, thank you. Thank you just mean, remember, gratitude can be expressed in a number of different ways. Maybe you don't feel a profound sense of gratitude, but it's also a polite thing to do. It is what we do in society. We say thank you and please to each other because it is polite. It is a way of kind of making society work. There are many reasons for saying thank you. We don't have to have a profound sense of gratitude. It is not lying. It is just expressing an appreciation that the other person has done something kind. Even if you don't feel gratitude, you can certainly appreciate that the other person has done an act of kindness. And that appreciation is enough for saying thank you. Right? So you understand, even if it's just intellectually, not with your heart, you understand that kindness is there. And so you say thank you for that reason. So it's important not to raise the bar too high. If you raise the bar so high that you have to feel gratitude every time, you're never going to say thank you. And then our society starts to fall apart because the lubricant that holds society together is actually going to be gone as well. So sometimes we have to be a bit pragmatic about these things. I don't think that is considered lying. I think that is what's taking it way too far to call that lying. All right. Hello, Ajahn. Referring to your morning talk, appreciate if you can share your experience of bliss during your meditation. It would help motivate and guide us beginners. Is there any simile in the sutta that can bring out empathy in individual, both kids and adults, one which is inspiring and relatable? Talking about bliss during meditation, the Buddha talks about this in the suttas all the time. And it's a very, very common experience for monastics and some lay people as well. It is not very uncommon. But the idea is just that as you start to get peaceful in your meditation, sometimes you start to feel gladness inside. You feel a sense of positive feeling inside, because you know that you're living well, you're starting to feel peaceful, you're rejoicing in the good company that is around, you're bringing up some good ideas in the mind, and they will naturally lead to a feeling of gladness, The mind is becoming energized, you're feeling a sense of mindfulness has become stronger. And then as you carry on with that gladness in the mind, it can move into even more gladness. And there comes a point when that gladness becomes, you start to feel like an energy in the body. It's like some kind of coursing happiness going through the body. This is what we often call the idea of rapture. When you feel a strong sense of happiness, physically and mentally at the same time. So when we talk about bliss in meditation, it has all these different levels to it. There's the very beginning levels of bliss when you just feel an ordinary kind of gladness. When you feel the joy of living with kindness, living with compassion, living with gratitude, living with generosity, living with an appreciation of the kalyanamittas, all of these kind of things. And then through the breath meditation, you take that gladness to a deeper and deeper levels, experiencing greater and greater blisses in the mind. Yeah, and these are things that is available for everyone. You don't have to be a super duper meditator to actually experience some of these things. There are so many levels of this. And just start off gently with yourself. And as you live in the right way, I can guarantee you that you also will be able to experience these things. These are normal factors of being a human being, the experience of bliss in meditation. Is there any simple sutra that can help bring out empathy in individuals, one which is inspiring and relating? Well, one of the suttas that I always talk about, and it's not really empathy, but more compassion. Compassion is really the critical word. Because empathy just means that you're feeling with someone else, and if you feel kind of too much of the other person's suffering, often it can be very draining, and you don't want things to become too draining for you. But compassion is the idea of moving towards results, wanting to help other people alleviate their suffering, and that is really what we want to do. And one of the best suttas that talk about this is the Anguttara 562. And that sutta, it talks about the idea of compassion. When you see, you use compassion, especially, you can use compassion in many ways, but you can use compassion, for example, when you cannot have metta for somebody because you cannot see any good qualities, then you can use compassion for that kind of person. Someone who has very many bad qualities in the world, a person who really is, doing all kind of bad things, because you can't have metta towards a person with many bad qualities, you can always have compassion towards them. So the idea is, a bad person, it says in that sutta, they are like a sick person. They are sick because a person who is sick and who doesn't get any help from a doctor or whatever, they are going to have big problems in the future. If you are really sick and there's no doctor around to support you, eventually you're going to die, or you're going to go very close to death. In the same way, a person who lives in a very bad way, they are also eventually going to have a lot of suffering in the future because they're living in a bad way. So you start to look at people in a different way. You start to understand how they're creating suffering for themselves. You start to look at the suffering. You start to put yourself in their shoes. It's interesting, I was in New York recently, and in New York, a lot of people kind of on the street, sleeping on the street. It was very cold. And you see these people sleeping on the street, and they have all these kind of blankets around them, begging to kind of survive. And it's actually very difficult. So then you start to see yourself, you put yourself in their shoes. You also have probably been a beggar sometime in the past. In a past life sometimes, we've probably all been in that kind of situation. And in the future, unless we do something to get out of this mess of being human beings, we're going to be there again in the future. So remind yourself, this person is no different from you. And when you see that this person is just like you, when you see yourself in their place, it starts to become painful to see the suffering of these people. You see this beggar, and it becomes almost unbearable to see these people on the street, because actually it is a very kind of painful kind of human existence to see that. So put yourself in the position of the other person. Try to understand what they're going through. Try to see the problem there, and then compassion starts to rise, and you actually want to help. You want to resolve it, because you see that there is a real issue there. All right. So, we'll come back to these ones in a second. Dear Ajahn, greed is often described as the great flood. Why is that so? Well, greed is very similar to craving. Craving is considered the stream. I was talking about the river before, the stream going down to the whirlpool and the crocodiles and the sharks and these kind of things. And so greed also is very similar. It's a flood. It's something that pulls you along. It's this powerful force inside of us that is actually very difficult to stop. It is not necessarily the word greed. It may not be the best one. The Pali word is loba. And the word loba includes all the desires in that world, the desires for the five sense world, and all of those kind of things. And if you look into your mind and you start to look at that craving, the desire that is always driving you on, always propelling you forward, always driving you to something else, it feels like a powerful force inside of you that is very, very hard to resist. And that is why it is called the flood. That is why it is kind of this powerful thing that it becomes almost irresistible. And that is the problem. All right, let's come to this number, this and large number of questions, 15 questions, and see what we can make of this. So, okay, let's start at the very beginning. So, Ajahn Brahm once said, "One should wish to be content, but how do you be content in this material world? The way you are content in the material world is to understand the limits of that material world, understand that what you have is good enough, that if you keep on pursuing it, it will never lead to contentment, and so you just let go of that pursuit because you understand it is the pursuit of fools." That's what you do. "Everything needs money. Even attending retreats needs money, and Malaysia is an expensive country where our incomes are too low and expenses like basic necessities are too high. How do we be content and work mundane jobs with low pay while living in Malaysia instead of migrating to other better economic countries with better standards of living here?" So you do what you have to do. I mean, obviously you have to live, you have to eat, you have to have the basics in life. So certainly you have to work for that. But you don't kind of put your expectations too high, right? You find that middle way whereby you have enough without really kind of striving too much for whatever. So you're right, of course. Of course you have to pay your expenses. Otherwise it's going to be very difficult. So find the middle way somewhere here. "After the pandemic, we realize that family and quality of life is important. To be able to do what you like to do is important, because life is short. But how do you be content and live a better standard of life, higher pay, lower expenses of life, etc.?" So, you just have to find a balance in life, right? Everything is about balance. So I'm not sure exactly what you are looking for here. Yes, you have enough to kind of look after yourself. One of the nice things that the Buddha says in the suttas is that, you know, when with the kind of the income that you have, you make yourself happy, you make your family happy, you make even the broader kind of community around you happy. In other words, you support yourself, you support your family, and you make people happy on that basis. So that is important. It's important to have enough kind of material means, yeah, to kind of go around and to meet everyone. But the point here is just that, you know, you can spend your entire life working incredibly hard and do all kinds of things and never find that contentment that you're looking for. And that is kind of the issue here. How much effort do you want to put in to do things that never is going to lead to real contentment? So you do enough. You do what you feel is required, but you don't overestimate the ability of the material things to give rise to contentment. You understand the limitations of these things. This is kind of the point here. Yeah, so there comes a point when you say, okay, I have enough. I'm going to be happy with what I have. Let me seek some real happiness in the world by living a more spiritual kind of existence. This is what it really is about. So find that balance in your life. I'm not saying that you shouldn't pursue, you know, enough money. Please do so. Please do whatever you feel is appropriate in your life. I'm not saying you shouldn't be successful in your career. Please be successful in your career. But also understand the limitations of these things. And when you understand the limitations of these things, you find a balance in your life, then you're going to be on the right track. So reflect on these things. Yeah, I'm not saying you should do what I say or anything like that. Find the right balance, then you're going to be on the right track. Okay, number two. Does being content means not wanting to improve one's skills in life? Not wanting to move up the corporate ladder, like become manager and acquire leadership skills? if you can want to move up the corporate ladder, and you can kind of have that as a desire, I think it is very difficult to let go of the desires, those desires completely. Yeah, it is very natural to have some desire to move on in one's professional life. And that is, it is okay. But remember that a lot of desire for these kind of things, very often it doesn't work out, right? Maybe you have a desire, maybe you work really hard to kind of move up the corporate ladder to have a higher income, but maybe you fail. Maybe it doesn't give the result that you want. So how do you feel if you fail? The harder you work to go up the corporate ladder, the harder you work to have a greater income, the more you desire those things. If you fail, the more painful the failing is going to be for you. Right? And the harder you work to go up the corporate ladder, the more desire you have for higher pay and all of these kind of things, the more likely it is that you will do immoral things in the pursuit of that. Because the desire to get there is going to say something inside of your mind. Okay, I'm willing to take a shortcut. I'm willing to lie a little bit. I'm willing to cheat a little bit to achieve my goal because it is so important to me. Yeah, this is what is happening if you want these things too much. And that is the downside. And once you start doing that, then you're creating bad karma for yourself. Then when you come to your deathbed, all that success that you had in this life is going to have to go anyway. And all that you have left are the qualities in your heart. And if those qualities in your heart have been destroyed by living in an immoral life, you're going to feel terrible on your deathbed. You don't have those things that you have acquired in your life because that has to go when you die. But what you have is you have accumulated negative feelings inside of you because you have been living badly. That is going to be very, very painful. It's going to be a very, very bad start for your next existence. This is how you have to learn to look at life. So how much desire do you want to have to move up the corporate ladder when you know that ultimately it's not going to give any real satisfaction anyway? Ultimately, you're going to have to give it up. How much does it matter to you? Find that balance. Okay, a little bit of desire for that is okay, but make sure you don't take it too far because then you end up destroying your own life as a consequence. How to practice kindness to self and others in this busy material world? You have to prioritize what is important, yeah? Kindness is more important than all the busyness in the material world. Prioritize in the right way. Remember what will lead to happiness in the long run. Yeah, remember what you are left with on your deathbed. Remember what really matters in this life. Everything else is borrowed goods. Kindness, good karma, is the only thing that you own, according to the Buddha, that you will take with you into the future. Remember to prioritize in your life. When you mention just watch your old age in the mirror and accept old age as a normal occurrence in life, does that mean we shouldn't take care of our health by going to the gym, working out, sleeping at reasonable hours and eating healthy? When I say these things, don't try to understand what I'm saying rather than adding things to what I'm saying. Yeah? Because what you are doing here by speaking in this way, you are adding a lot of extra to what I'm trying to actually convey when I'm talking about old age. Yeah, because if you do this, you are just kind of, it's like you are, you're kind of rejecting it by adding things, by making it more onerous than actually it is. So my point here is just the idea to be realistic about life. Of course you should look after your health, yeah, reasonably. But again, not going overboard. It's about finding the right balance with everything in the world. So look after your health. Do the right thing. Yeah, look after things in the right way. But also be realistic about what life really is about. Then you're going to be on the right track. Yeah? Please. Yeah? Yes? It needs wisdom, indeed. Yeah. 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 Right, exactly. So I think many of these questions that are coming here are things that you can really understand yourself if you try to understand it. Yeah? It is not that hard to understand. instead of asking me all these questions, sit back and ask these questions of yourself, because I think you know the answer already. It's just that you know, maybe you want to take the opportunity while I'm here and see what I can say about these things. Sometimes we can ask too many questions. And sometimes much more important to allow the wisdom to come from within. When it comes from within you, and when you are able to understand these things, then it's going to be powerful for you. If I tell you these things, you probably, you know, it's not going to be very useful for you anyway. Okay, let me, I will do my job, and I will continue. Yes, I expect most of these questions are going to be exactly the same kind of questions, all the way down to the bottom. We will go through it. So please eat healthy, right? Okay, next one. If energy cannot be created nor destroyed, then where does our energy go after enlightenment? According to Ajahn Brahm, after enlightenment, our consciousness disappears. Does this mean our energy has disappeared? When things are gone after the awakening, everything disappears. If consciousness disappears, yes, energy also disappears, because the energy is obviously tied up with consciousness. So that energy will then maybe, So this idea that energy cannot be created nor destroyed, that is the physical energy of the world. Mental energy, to my mind, is a different kind of energy. So it doesn't, the ordinary laws of physics don't apply to that, as far as I can see here. How to escape the prison when our physical body are in the prison, and the need of the dump to survive in the prison? Remember that the mind and the body are two different things. So even though it is true that the physical body is part of the five sense world, the mind can release its grip on that five sense world by giving up craving and desire for it. So mind and body are not the same. It is the mind we're talking about here. Is pursuing monetary wealth and passive income considered living in a dump? Is it a bad pursuit using chasing wealth, monetary, and neglecting the Buddhist teachings? It is up to you. You have to do what you think is right. The purpose of these teachings is just really to give you some kind of guidance in life. Give you some guidance, give you some idea, something to reflect on. If you want to reject it, please do so. I have no vested interest whether you believe in these things or not. It is really entirely up to you. If you don't want to believe in it, fine. The point is just, this is how I understand the world. This is how I understand the Buddha teaching the world. Remember, it's a gradual thing. You don't give up the monetary things. You don't give up that world straight away. It is a gradual movement of things. Do what you feel comfortable with. And if you don't feel comfortable with these things, then don't do what you don't feel comfortable with. Only when you're comfortable should you do something. It is really as simple as that. What I'm saying, don't take it on board in the blind way. Do what you feel works for you. That is the right way of thinking about these things. Otherwise, it's not going to work for you. There's nothing wrong with pursuing monetary wealth as long as you also pursue kindness. How to be your authentic self and stay happy for not caring what other people talk about you? The point about not caring about what other people say about you is that most people don't understand much anyway. Most people are blind, they are deluded, they don't understand what the world is about. If you have integrity, if you know whether you're living in the right way, in a good way, it doesn't matter what other people say. What matters is that you feel that you are living in the right way. That is what is important in the world. If other people want to say bad things about you, they have a problem. You don't have a problem. And I often think, what would the Buddha say about me? And if the Buddha is happy with my conduct, then I'm okay. If other people in the world want to say a bad thing about me, actually they are the ones who have a problem, not me. That is, to me, the right way to think about that. How to live courageously? Does being a nomadic help embracing our true, authentic self and have the courage to live? Does being a nomadic or monastic, what does it mean, nomadic? Monastic, is that what it means? Okay, maybe it meant to mean nomastic. How to live courageously? Well, the courage comes from the confidence that you are doing the right thing. If you really feel that you are doing the right thing, that you're living according to the Buddha's teaching, you become automatically courageous because you don't care so much about the rest of the world. Yeah, then you live courageously, whether as a lay person or as a monastic. Why Buddhism is so logical religion and not other religions like Christianity, Hinduism and Islam? Why Buddhism is a logical religion? Well, you just look at the religions and you decide what you think is right, yeah? And you pursue what you think is right. That is really what it comes down to. To me, I grew up in a Christian context. I knew a little bit about Christianity. It didn't make any sense to me. To me, the Christian doctrines, I could not make any sense of it. And so I had no choice but to reject it. That was my personal experience. You decide for yourself what you think is appropriate. When I wake up in the morning, I can hear music playing in the background while worrying about the decisions I made. Sometimes I think, worry about things, challenges I have to face for the day. How do I stop all these thoughts from coming in? How do I stop the music from playing in the back of my head? How do I have peace of mind in the morning when I wake up? And also keep thinking what I should do the next when I wake up. Live well, live with kindness, be a good person. And as you do that, gradually the anxieties and the problems of life will fade away. Number 12, since Hinduism started before Buddhism, why can't we say that Hinduism is the purest religion? And again, you know, if you think about these things, I think you will know the answer. It is not about what started first. It is about insight into the nature of reality. Yeah? That is what matters. And insight into the nature of reality is not about what came first. If what came first was the best teaching, then the monkeys 1.5 million years ago would have the purest teaching. Yeah? Because they came before everyone else. So it is about insight and understanding. That is the important thing here. When one of your family members has renounced, are they still your family members? Can you still treat them like your family members? You deal, speak to that family member and see what they say about it. It is a bit of both. Yeah, they have renounced. They are still a family member in some ways, but of course it also changes things a little bit. Question number 14. Should we build a passive income that could support our retirement first if we want to renounce? Because our body is still in the physical world and need physical monetary to survive. We also need visa to travel around, and if we are not a professional qualified in our career, it will be a tough process to get visa and travel around once we renounce. Should we pursue the professional career before renouncing? If you are really thinking about renouncing, come and have a chat with me personally and we can discuss these issues. Because I'm not sure if you are going to renounce yet. I'm not sure. They're all up to all of these questions. But if you really are interested in renouncing, have a chat with me and I will tell you how we do things in our monastery to give you some idea how to deal with these issues. Question number 15. Last one. Yay, last one. Old age and sickness is a normal occurrence in life. How does the renounced afford the medical fees and care needed if they fall sick? Usually you will be living in dependence of some kind of preceptor, some kind of person, and usually there will be someone there to support you when you need it. Yeah, which is one of the beautiful things about monastic life. So I would really recommend you to think about some of these things for yourself, because a lot of these answers will become obvious to you if you reflect on them. And I think sometimes if you ask too many questions like this, it actually just detracts from this kind of Q&A session. Yeah, it does. It just becomes too many things, and it becomes too kind of detailed in a way. Focus on a few main issues that you need to understand, and then you're going to be on the right track. Otherwise, it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be so useful, to be quite honest. Anyway, there's a couple of more questions here. We will take those tomorrow, because I think we probably have more time later on. Now it's already getting very late. So let's just pay homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we call it a day here.